The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Another exciting show, as usual, here on Thursday afternoon. We're going to spend the first half of the show talking about the emergence of digital media in Washington and how it's transforming the policymaking process and the political process. Then we're going to spend some time talking about the evolution of the business aviation community during this economic downturn. And finally, we'll close up with something ripped straight from the headlines, a dispute in the legal world over where the federal government is going to build one of its high-tech, high-threat, toxic biotoxin, research facilities here in the United States. A fascinating legal and political debate that's going on here in Washington as we speak. But we're going to start in the digital arena, and our guest this afternoon is David Almasy. David Almasy is the former White House Internet Communications Director and has been on the show before. So, Dave, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Doing great, Kevin. How are you?
Terrific. Now, Dave is with Edelman Media Worldwide now. Is that correct, Dave?
Yeah, Edelman Public Relations. Yeah, I came over here back in March.
Very good. And, again, a guy who basically helped the George W. Bush White House build its web presence from scratch and really do some of the first innovative things on the web. Frankly, some of the things that President Obama has claimed responsibility for being the first to do. I believe my buddy Dave beat him to the punch during the Bush presidency. But, Dave, let's talk a little bit about how the .gov community is connecting with citizens and people who are advocates in more direct ways here. Even since in the first 6 months of the Obama administration, you have to see a lot of new things rolling out at the presidential level and at the congressional level. So why don't you start with the big picture there?
Sure. Well, to your point earlier, I think it's kind of interesting if you look back at the evolution of the communications mediums, throughout history. You know, we think of, the first radio president, for example, a lot of people think it's FDR. But in reality, it was actually Calvin Coolidge was the first to really use the radio from the White House, and then Herbert Hoover after him. But the problem was that, the network wasn't built yet. You know, back in 1923, when the first, radio was being used, it couldn't reach people. So now, 10 years later, NBC launches with its, 37 networks around the country. And now whenever FDR would, broadcast, people around the country could actually hear them. And so that was the golden age of radio. So although the medium itself was being used, it just wasn't able to really permeate throughout society. So that's why we think of FDR as the first radio president. And then you look through, for the first television president, a lot of people think of JFK because of the debate between Nixon and JFK during the 1960 campaign, and they think he's the first one to really do it. And of course Reagan came along as the great communicator and really used that medium. But actually, it was President Eisenhower was the first president to do a live televised news conference from the White House, and he hired Robert Montgomery, who was an actor at the time, who helped advise him, and because of all the footage that they were providing out of the White House at the time, the newscasts extended their coverage from 15 minutes at night to 30 minutes, and because of all that, they gave President Eisenhower an Emmy But yet we refer to JFK, a lot of us, as the first television president. So I think as we look in terms of the internet and how, you know, the golden age of the internet, I think we're just, it's just beginning.
Well, it's fascinating. You mentioned the first radio president, to think that, you know, there probably aren't very many people left who would have had a chance to hear even FDR's fireside chats. You'd have to be in your 80s to have been old enough to remember sitting down next to your big coffee table sized radio and listening to him. And so, you know, you wonder if you and I, when we're old and sitting at the retirement home, we'll talk about the first Twitter presidency with quite
exactly. I think, you know, it's funny because, you know, the first internet president, you know, was Bill Clinton. And he was the first to have a website at whitehouse.gov. And to his credit, he really encouraged those in his administration and all the federal cabinet agencies to have web presences. And, you know, we look back at some of those sites today and we might chuckle at how they look, just like people probably 15 years from now will look back at the sites that we use today and say, gosh, it's so antiquated. But for the time, it was very forward thinking. And, you know, so I've often referred to, you know, President Clinton as the first internet president. President Bush is the first digital president, meaning the first that we were able to publish content in a way that was accessible, whether it was audio or video or text or photos. We were churning out tons of content every day, and it all was housed on whitehouse.gov, and then people would take it from there and start to put it in other places on blogs and so forth. But what Obama has the ability to be is really the first social media president. And so as these websites that live in the cloud, as they say, these Facebooks and Twitters and YouTube, you know, the power of those sites is that, you know, these servers that are owned by these companies are housing the content in the cloud. In other words, it doesn't live on your computer solely. You take it, you know, you take pictures of your family vacation or whatever, and then you come back and you upload, you know, a set of those up to Facebook. Well, now those photos live there, and the power of that is now you're able to share it in a way, because those that you're connected with on Facebook or those that have access to your Flickr feed or whatever can see it, and it doesn't just live in one place. I mean, you probably remember emailing 10 photos to friends and attaching it to the email, and it would gum up everybody's servers and crash everything. And so those days are over. And so I think if you apply this to politics, you know, this is what, you know, the White House has the advantage now of, you know, having folks gather in these communities and share information.
Yeah, it's jarring, Dave, just the speed with which some of the social media is taking place. I've been on Facebook, I don't know, about 18 months, and I remember, mm-hmm. you know, when it got on, a lot of people younger sort of scoffed at, oh, you know, gosh, Facebook's going to pot, you old people are on. my mom joined 2 weeks ago, and it really took me aback that she joined, and then she started writing on my wall, and that sort of just made me realize, wow, you know, my mom and dad, who barely... you know, they don't spend much time on the computer, but they're out there. My mom is connecting with her college classmates for reunion purposes and stuff like that. And now, it's just as you said, she's able to see the grandkids via upload a little faster and easier. But Dave, let's shift back. I want to talk a little bit about. I want to walk through the federal agencies and Congress and political candidates and what they're doing with some of this new media. And I want to start maybe with your thoughts about. How this is affecting the presidency and the executive branch's promises to be more open and transparent. You know, President Obama had made a great hay of saying he'd be the most transparent president of all, and you know, he set up recovery.org to go with his plans for the stimulus package. And then lo and behold, he's gotten a pretty decent amount of negative press coverage about how untransparent recovery.org is, how clunky it is, and how hard it is for people to follow where the money is going. So is it sort of, you know, is it really a double-edged sword, or you have to be very careful with the expectations you set for the public with what you're going to do in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to recovery.gov, I think, you know, the first, you know, bit of criticism is that when they priced out how much it was going to cost, the initial estimate was somewhere in $84 million. Now, you know, I don't know what website is worth $84 million. I'm not even sure Facebook is worth that much. It's interesting in terms of the cost of that. I think they've since walked it back, to $19 million. And, and what we're looking at is a way to, you know, pull together information, to aggregate it, make it available. And this goes back to what really people view as being the purpose of a .gov site. You know, is it to provide general services? Is it to provide information? Is there a PR aspect to it? And I think a lot of people believe that it should just be about data. you know, just publish the data and let the think tanks out there analyze all the data and come up with their perceptions of what's actually happening in government. So instead of you telling me all of your plans about immigration, you know, put out up there, you know, how many fences are out there, how many border guards are there, how many people are you know, returned to their countries, what are the costs of all that, and then let people debate that as to what the policy is and where it should go. I think they've had to walk back a couple of those things in terms of, you know, people who are commenting on legislation, supposedly. So non-emergency legislation was supposed to be evaluated for 5 days before the president would sign it, and they've had to pull back on that. You know, they went onto Facebook and asked for questions for healthcare forums and Facebook and Twitter, and then you know, Robert Gibbs got pretty much taken to task by Chip Reed and Helen Thomas about how, well, who's selecting these questions, and are these pre-selected questions, and are you siphoning out all the tough questions?
Well,
so I think that, you know, their aims are good. I think what they're trying to do is to open it up in a way that it is more open and transparent. But they run in smack dab in all the same issues that you know, that we dealt with, as well as every other White House before us, in terms of security and privacy and who could have access to all those sites. So if you work in the White House now, I think Robert Gibbs is quoted on a C-SPAN interview last week about, you know, about how that no White House staff were able to access Twitter. And that's not entirely true. There are some on the new media team who actually run the White House Twitter account. But the majority of those who work within the walls of the EOP, the Executive Office of the President, whether you're in, you know, the Executive Office building or whether you're in the West Wing proper, they can't access these sites. And there's a number of different limitations for that. So whether you're campaigning or governing, it's two different things. You know, as candidates, the gates are open. You can pretty much use the web for whatever you want to use it for, as long as it doesn't conflict with if it's a sitting incumbent. Obviously, you have to draw a pretty stark line between, you know, your official duties and those that are political.
Dave, we're going to go to break here in just a second, but a quick question. If you were back at the White House doing what you did before, what's the one thing they're not doing in the digital world that you'd have them doing?
Well, I think they're doing a lot on these social media sites, but it seems to me that they're not really providing that content on whitehouse.gov. So instead of posting photos on the White House site, they're putting it in Flickr. Or, you know, they'll put up video of Robert Gibbs on YouTube, but they're not embedding that back on the White House site. So I think I would just better marry the two. It's one thing to have it live in these other sites, but it's got to be on whitehouse.gov first.
I see. So, yeah, you got to be really sort of a digital sleuth to find it all, and how many people are that interested.
Yeah, listen, we're talking having with, the time to search for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. David Almasy here, the former White House Internet Communications Director in the Bush administration. We're going to come back in just a minute and talk more about digital media and politics. Stay with us here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, folks, welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with David Almasy, digital political guru. David, want to talk a little bit now about some of the high-stakes policy battles that are going on in Congress involving the White House, things like the cap-and-trade bill, but more importantly, perhaps the health care reform bill. The House gets out today, I believe, tomorrow, and the Senate's going to get out a week from now. Those folks are going to go home and have a chance to influence the voters about how they should feel about health care reform and the votes that loom in September and October. So take us a little bit into the hearts and minds of the digital consultants on the for congressmen and senators and outside third-party groups as they try and influence this fight.
Sure. So I think, you know, this is one of the things that I think the president wanted to do was to get this legislation pushed through before the break, because obviously as the members and senators are going back to their districts and their states, they're going to be, you know, interacting with their constituents and you know, they're going to bring back a lot of these sorts of complaints. And if you look at some of the poll numbers, obviously the president's got a real uphill climb on this. But I guess just today they announced that some of the Blue Dog Democrats have agreed to kind of broker some sort of a deal. But what I find interesting is, last week, Congressman Fleming, there's all this conversation about, is mainstream media dead? And so Congressman Fleming from Louisiana was on Fox News and he had presented his resolution where he had wanted that any member of Congress who votes for this healthcare legislation, must also agree to give up their federal healthcare plan, whether it's for them or their staff or their family. And of course, no Democrats had signed on to that, but he was announcing it at the time on Fox News, and he said, we're going to be keeping a running tally of this on our website at fleming.house.gov. And so, of course, I'm watching it, on television on Fox, and I went to the site and it was down. It was down for about 45 minutes, and they had later come back and said, that basically the traffic to the site was so heavy, and they estimated about 2 million people were actually watching Fox News at the time. And so, the immediate error that came up, normally if you go to something on the web and you can't find it, it's a 404 error.
Yeah,
that says, the page can't be found. This is a 403.9 error was what I got. And it basically said too many people accessing the site all at once. And so I kind of jokingly refer to it as too much democracy all at once. So so I think some of these infrastructure issues are definitely still at play here, too.
Well, so tell us, if you're advising a third-party group, let's say, you're the an association that opposes the health care bill that's pending in the House, you've got members nationwide, and more importantly, you've got people you serve nationwide that you think are interested, how are you going to use things like a Facebook, a Twitter, anything else, a blog, to sort of get your message out and get people fired up enough to contact their members of Congress and influence the process?
Yeah, and there are a lot of these sites that are cropping up too, whether it's the opt-out site, for the Obama care, you know, and it's keeping an eye on what's happening on your specific Facebook page, on Twitter. You know, I know Claire McCaskill has said publicly that she tracks anybody who tweets with #MO, which is the hashtag for Missouri, and so she's pulling all this stuff together. So, you know, whether it's online petitions, whether it's, you know, getting folks to rally around the cause by joining a group, and really, you know, what we call at Edelman, it's the social majority. You know, it's the ability to create this groundswell of communications and aggregating it in a way that is meaningful to the member. So the old days, it would be, you know, sending a letter or flooding the phones. Well, we're not saying don't do that. You know, you got to do that as well. We're saying that there's another digital channel for those who prefer to click the call on their mobile phone to actually connect that way, or to join the group, or to send an email, or to basically just, you know, create a video and tag the member in the headline. So there's a lot of different ways to pull this together, and members more and more are becoming a little bit more attuned with this channel because their staff, quite frankly, are involved in this in their personal lives. There are a lot of options out there depending on what the mission is, if you want to defeat a bill or if you want a bill to pass, and, you know, it's just another way to communicate. And more importantly, there's the concept of search, so that when people are searching for your issue, when they go to Google, right now Google's the number one search engine, obviously. Number two is actually YouTube. And most people think, well, wait, I thought YouTube was a video sharing channel. Well, of course it is, but it's owned by Google. And so most people, if they're looking for something in Google and they can't find it, they will go to YouTube second to look for it. And then behind that is Yahoo and now Microsoft's new Bing. So it's important that you're publishing content in a way that's findable. So I think that, you know, so our advice to clients is, you know, are you tagging blog posts appropriately? Are you communicating with your audiences? And are you giving them the ability to gather around an area online to voice their opinion?
Dave, tell me, though, you know, all these, it's getting so easy to send an email to my congressman about an issue I care about and, you know, fill in a blank or two. How is that actually being received on the Hill? I mean, is it sort of the equivalent of, we got this stack of postcards by people who just scribbled their name down but don't actually care about this issue? Or do they take it, you know, at some point, does enough of those become, well, we better look into this issue?
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem we also had at the White House. I mean, keep in mind, we were getting millions of emails a week. And, you know, the Presidential Correspondence Office, you know, their primary job was to respond to those letters that came in via snail mail. But obviously, you know, we were tracking those that were coming in via email as well. And the amount of spam was the bigger issue. I mean, just the volume of that alone. And then we had constantly people trying to send us viruses. And so we had to pretty much lock down, you know, the ability to make sure that the communications coming in were from actual people, and you're not just emailing some random address trying to cause harm or just trying to flood the channel. So this is something that the Hill is definitely dealing with, you know, the way that we handled it and the way that some of the folks that I've spoken with on the Hill who manage this on a day-to-day basis is, you know, they're basically aggregating emails and sorting them in some cases by hand in Outlook. And say, hey, you know, this week we got 300 on this issue, and then they're publishing reports and kind of sending those, you know, up the ladder so that they're communicating, you know, this is what we're hearing about from our constituents. Because as you know, it's the other challenge of social media is that you're not bound by those geographic, you know, boundaries. So it's impossible to tell that if someone is sending you, you know, a Twitter message, you know, if they're not in your district or if they're not from your state, it's hard to tell if they don't indicate that on Twitter. If they
right.
don't say, hey, I live in St. Louis, Missouri, it's impossible to actually prove that. And I've made the argument it's actually impossible to prove that when they're calling as well. But, yeah, so it is becoming a little bit difficult. But at the same time, that's why the concept of the groundswell is important, because if it is a social majority of people, then the megaphone is a little bit louder. And I think that once you can break through that, you know, you're not relying upon the mainstream media to run your story, because you're actually able to get a little bit of buzz on the web, and that's always going to bubble up.
Gotcha. We'll talk a little bit about, I guess, the president has sort of he took his election campaign and turned it into some sort of interest group that he can tap for fights like this healthcare fight. But they don't seem to have anywhere near the footprint they had last year. And part of that is just the excitement of the election and a lot of people to sort of go away after the election. But if you were over there running that group, Dave, what are they not doing that you would recommend that they do?
Well, this is the challenge. I mean, listen, the Bush campaign in 2004 did the very same thing, where they tried to take, you know, the momentum from the campaign and transfer that into a private group. And this is what the Obama folks have done with the Organizing for America. And they estimated, I think the last number I saw was around 13 million people that they had collected, you know, whether it was emails or cell numbers or what have you, although I think the mobile numbers haven't actually been made public. But 13 million, and of course, you know, a slice of those will probably be Republicans or those who are just trying to keep tabs on what the campaign was doing for opposition research and such. But the challenge again is that, you know, on a campaign, you're driving for that one day. You know, you're getting everybody together motivated around one day. You're getting people registered to vote and, you know, and you're pushing for that one day. When it comes to governing, though, it's more of a long-term venture. You know, a bill doesn't happen in one day, even if it is health care. So I think what we're looking at is the ability to maintain that momentum and to know when to go to the well. When do you say, you know, you can't mobilize everyone on every issue. If it's going to be healthcare today and it's going to be energy tomorrow and it's going to be, you know, whatever, you know, you have to figure out when do you want to put the president out there, number one, and number two, when do you go and basically email everyone in your database and say, this is what we want you to be, you know, vocal about. And if you do that every week, over time, that's going to wear thin, I think, because, you know, people's time and efforts are spread on family and work and all sorts of other things. And, you know, citizens don't necessarily have the time to act on every issue. I think it's going to be a balance.
One more question here. Real fast, what do you say to businesses, entities that want to be engaged in Washington? What's a quick checkup to know, hey, we have enough social media or we need to be doing more in this area if we want to be the influential force we hope to be?
Well, I mean, the bare minimum is you have to have a presence online in some way. And I think, but it's got to be mapped more importantly to your business objectives. You know, so people will say, hey, we need to be on Facebook. And I would always reply with, well, why? You know, what is it about Facebook that you think is going to be, helpful to your goals and objectives? You know, what is the audience you're trying to reach? What is the message? Are you trying to build awareness or are you trying to sell a product or, you know, what is it? And so, you know, depending on what your, you know, specific mission is, that will help determine the strategy and tactics behind it. But really all these sites, the value of them, of YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and Flickr and all that, is just the ability to share. And that people can, you know, so that if you and I are connected on Facebook, and I believe we are, and because we share some things in common, and if you're posting something about something that you and I care about, then I because of the value of that relationship, it actually matters a little bit more because it's coming from a trusted source as opposed to from an organization, from a CEO who I may not know, and so therefore it has a little bit more value there. So it's about having a presence online and actually leveraging it.
And I think with the speed of things today, you've got to be committed to keeping it up to date. It can't be a stale website. It can't be a stale Twitter feed or Facebook page, or it'll go away. Dave, hit us real fast with the places people can get in contact with you and hear more about what you're up to.
Sure. So day job is Edelman.com, PR, and I also blog at CapitalGig.com, so feel free to reach out to me there.
Great. Well, we've been joined by Dave Almasy talking about digital media and the intersection with politics and policy. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about business aviation here on Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. As we continue to examine how the economic downturn is reshaping many sectors of our economy, we reach out to various business leaders across the country. Today we're talking about the world of business aviation. We've got two guests with us, Ed Bolin, who is the president and CEO of the National Business Aviation Association, and David Meyer from the Dallas office of the law firm of Patton Boggs, and an expert in many sectors of the business aviation corporate legal world. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. How are you guys today?
Good morning,
Kevin.
Well, let's start with Mr. Bolin. Can you tell us a little bit about where business aviation is and why it is so important to the American economy today?
Well, business aviation is essential to our nation's economy because it allows companies to be productive and to be very efficient in meeting some of their transportation challenges. We've got companies all over the country. Actually, 85% of the companies that use business aviation are small and mid-sized companies, and they use it to do the things that can't be done on the commercial airlines. They use it to do multiple sites in a single day, to visit communities with little or no commercial airline service. They use it to move teams of people and have them discuss proprietary information en route. And a lot of times they use it to move parts and equipment. So it's a fundamental tool for a lot of businesses, most of them small, to be more productive and more efficient than their competition.
Very good. David, tell us, I know you're very involved in your legal practice with the industry. Talk to me about the current business trends impacting business aviation.
Well, Kevin, there's no doubt that the economic crisis has taken a toll on business aviation, just as it has other sectors of the economy. This is a good news, bad news situation today. The good news is that although inventory levels have gone up, and prices or values of aircraft have come down, what we're seeing is the beginning of stabilization in those two areas with some expectation that not in the near term, but going forward in the next year or so, we'll see inventories begin to reverse and go down and prices to stabilize. There are a lot of businesses doing less business today simply because the economy has put so much pressure on corporate profits and the optics in the business, but that has given some leeway to the start of more takeoffs and landings of aircraft, which has been reduced considerably during the crisis. We think that the 2007 levels, which were really spectacular by industry standards, should come back at least close to that level, perhaps not that level, in the 18-month, two-year time frame. And with some luck, manufacturers who have experienced a lot of cancellations or deferrals of deliveries of new aircraft will see some upturn, but they are very constrained and, I think, disappointed with some cancellations of aircraft deliveries.
Very good. Now, Ed, let's come back to you. I know that the National Business Aviation Association has a No Plane, No Gain initiative that talks a little bit about the importance of business aircraft to our economy and to our transportation system. You want to talk a little bit about that initiative and how you all are impacting the economy?
Well, thanks, Kevin. No Plane, No Gain is a advocacy campaign that was started because over the past several months, there has been a very negative reality of what business aviation is. So in February, we launched No Plane, No Gain, so that people would understand that in the United States, business aviation means jobs, 1.2 million jobs, manufacturing jobs, service jobs, banking, finance, insurance, a lot of really important jobs in the United States. It also serves as a lifeline to communities with little or no airline service. And within the last year, we've had over 100 communities have lost all or substantially all of their service. If you're trying to be headquartered in one of those communities or have plants, facilities, or customers, you need business aviation. Business aviation is also a great tool for small and mid-sized companies to help them stay competitive, efficient, productive. And, of course, there are over 15,000 humanitarian flights where companies are donating their airplanes to fly organ transplants, take cancer patients to treatment. This is the reality of business aviation, and No Plane, No Gain is promoting that reality to the public at large.
Very good. Well, Ed, let's stick with you. You got your hat on here as the president and CEO of the National Business Aviation Association. What again, I want to talk about the economy. What do people need to know about the number and kind of jobs that are created by business aviation?
Well, a lot of people think about pilot jobs or they think about the manufacturing jobs. But as I said before, this is 1.2 million jobs in the United States. And it gets to someone in the local community who's selling fuel to airplane operations. It gets to companies that are insuring airplanes, financing airplanes, catering for airplanes, people teaching flight lessons. There are a tremendous number of individuals. There are a lot of communities. And indeed, I'd argue our entire country really depends on general aviation as a jobs generator. It's a real economic development opportunity for communities that don't have commercial airline service. General aviation is what they are expecting, business aviation, to allow them to keep companies, to attract companies, and to have jobs in communities.
Very good, very good. Well, David, let's get back to you. I know you spend a lot of time with the guys who actually pay for the business aviation through a variety of financial transactions. Now, from a distance, it looks to me like the financial world sort of sitting on the sidelines, perhaps waiting for the economy to bottom out, and there's maybe not a lot of financing available for me to go out and buy a G5 or G4 or whatever for my company. But what kind of financing do prospective purchasers of business aircraft expect to find in today's marketplace?
Well, thanks, Kevin. There's no doubt that capital is constrained in the current market, and that people who have an interest in acquiring aircraft are feeling that strain. For deals that are available, the pricing is up, and so is the rigorous nature of the diligence that lenders and lessors will apply. The market is looking at longer approvals to get deals done by some of the traditional and larger lenders. Each of those lenders or lessors will tell you they're open for business. But the reality is that credit people have unprecedented power to say no, which they do. So what you see is that banks and other lessors will do deals that are relatively simple in nature, that we described as vanilla deals. What's an interesting trend is there are a few banks doing non-recourse financings, which means they'll value the aircraft at what they think the value of that asset is on an asset basis only. They will not look for credit backing, and so and they will not do the same kind of credit diligence, which seems exactly opposite of what you'd expect in this economy. What they will do is more diligence on the asset value of the aircraft, taking into account what I mentioned earlier, which is the downslope of values, and then give a loan based upon that value alone, and see if their fortunes are better with that product. While a lot of the credit-based lenders are applying such high scrutiny to their deals that a lot of them simply don't get off first base.
Well, what about, let me flip it around, for those people who already own some business aviation and perhaps their economic conditions have changed, they need to restructure or work out their financing. What are some of the terms and conditions that you see now taking place in these workout documents?
Well, there's an interesting trend. In an earlier speech I gave, I suggested that lawyers take a fresh look at documents and the terms that are in the documents to manage through this extraordinary downturn that we're facing. And the results that I see is that there has been some development or enhancement of financial covenants and improved risk management. But interestingly, documents have remained a little, pretty much little unchanged. The real key here has been the diligence and credit approval process has gotten much more difficult. So as a result, you'll see tightening of covenants. You're seeing lenders or lessors having more access to aircraft and their the various staff, reduced cure periods for defaults, and other provisions that are promote the diligence that they need to assure themselves that they'll get repaid.
I see. Well, Ed, let's come back to you. Tell me a little bit about where you see business aviation charting a course over the next year or so in terms of a very active Congress and regulatory agency. What policy changes are you concerned with and tracking?
Well, we're tracking a couple of different things. One in the area of taxes. There has been an ongoing debate on Capitol Hill about whether we will move the business aviation community from paying a simple fuel tax to a much more administratively burdened user fee system. That debate, I'm pleased to report, seems largely behind us. The aviation bill spending in both the House and the Senate continue to build upon the understood and proven fuel tax and no longer discuss user fees. We're also dealing with security regulations. We had some regulations that were proposed by the Transportation Security Administration. Fortunately, through the notice of proposed rule and comment period, we're seeing that the comments that have been made are really resonating, and we expect some changes in that. But we're also finally keeping an eye on some of the environmental legislation that is moving on Capitol Hill that would involve transportation, including business aviation. So tax issues or user fee charges, security regulations, and environmental regulations or laws are things we're keeping an eye on.
A very important time, I'm sure, for the association on Capitol Hill. I've got about 30 seconds left. David, do you have any sort of wrap-up thoughts here?
Well, one of the things that we see, Kevin, is the broad economic indicators showing some stability in the economy generally. The Federal Reserve reported that in this morning's Wall Street Journal. With that stability, we expect that business aviation will show some of the same stability, hopefully some redeployment of aircraft and workouts, and an increase of financing so that the future will certainly not be dim, and hopefully it'll brighten as time goes forward.
Very good. Well, we've been joined by Ed Bolin, who is the president and CEO of the National Business Aviation Association. Ed, do you want to give out your contact information here?
Well, people can find NBAA at www.nbaa.org, where they can reach us at 202-783-9000.
9,000. Well, best wishes to your association. And, David, do you have contact information for folks who want to contact you about financing of these deals?
Yes, certainly. Kevin, I can be reached at dmayer, M-A-Y-E-R, at pattenboggs.com, and my direct line, 214-758-1545.
Great. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. We're going to be back in just a minute with a terrific story about what the government is thinking about putting a high-risk research laboratory in America. Back more in just a second.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions.
Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, you know, from time to time, we like to highlight federal controversies, and we've got a doozy for you today. The federal government's in the process of replacing a facility called Plum Island. That's where our armed forces and other scientists work on highly infectious diseases and pathogens, trying to figure out how to protect us from them. That's critical work for the United States, and we're about to build a new facility nationwide. But where that facility gets built and the circumstances under which the site was chosen is a point of great political and legal controversy here in Washington right now. And so joining us is lawyer Michael Giuffre. He's a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of the law firm of Patton Boggs and one of the city's more decorated litigators. And he is a prime player in the dispute over where to site this new $700 million research facility. Now, Michael, welcome to the show. My understanding is this facility has been selected by the Department of Homeland Security for Kansas. But tell us a little bit about this this research program, and then let's talk about how it got to Kansas.
Sure. Right now, DHS is currently conducting research on Plum Island, New York, as you indicated, of highly infectious and deadly foreign animal and zoonotic diseases, which are contagions that can pass from animals to humans. And these are the kinds of pathogens that researchers have to wear spacesuits to study because there's no known cure. DHS is now planning to move that research facility to Manhattan, Kansas, and we really have to stop that from happening.
Gotcha. Well, tell us a little bit about how it got to Kansas.
Sure. DHS did an analysis of where it wanted to put a gleaming new facility to research foot and mouth disease and other exotic diseases. Right now, though, it's taking this huge risk that it's going to expose Americans to these deadly diseases by putting it in Manhattan, Kansas. In addition to the research that it plans to do on foot and mouth disease, which is 100% contagious, it also plans to study a variety of other illnesses that would just have a devastating impact if they were released into the U.S. economy. For example, all U.S. beef exports would be shut down indefinitely. We would have to slaughter millions of sheep, cattle, and pigs, and the entire farm economy in Kansas and surrounding areas would be obliterated. And the risk of a release here is great. Manhattan, Kansas is smack dab in the middle of Tornado Alley, and DHS itself has said that an F3 tornado will destroy the facility. Just last year, an F4 tornado hit that exact spot where they planned to build it. So really nonsensical that they plan to do it there.
Michael, you had a great quote. Folks, this was a front-page article in the Washington Post earlier this week. Michael was quoted as saying, there's a reason they call it Tornado Alley, and you just sort of outlined it. I mean, they call it that because these things come through frequently. They're part of the spring experience in Kansas, and an unfortunate part of it is they're regularly hit with pretty serious tornadoes. And I guess, Michael, maybe they picked there because there wasn't a cliffside available or something built on a fault line that that we could build on. I mean, this seems almost like classic government snafu, where we pick some place that just Joe average citizen scratches his head and says, why are we doing that there?
Right. Well, despite the fact that it's almost impossible to completely secure a building from tornadoes due to the high-velocity missile impacts that occur with tornadoes, the agency put it in Kansas, and it appears primarily because there was such a huge political push in Kansas to get that facility placed there. Senator Brownback and Senator Roberts fought very hard for this to happen, and the reason, as they have specified in many press releases boasting about their activities to bring it there, is that it's going to be a very large boost to the local economy of Manhattan, Kansas. So they're putting money in front of safety.
I see. Well, tell us where do things stand right now? I know that even since that Washington Post article came out early this week, there's been some new news made on this situation.
That's correct. As soon as the Washington Post article came out, Congress called for a hearing on this GAO report that was about to be released. That hearing, which was scheduled for this morning, just got postponed, I think, primarily due to the health care legislation process. However, we did actually have the GAO release its report today, and that report is damning. It has gone through in detail and identified how DHS failed to conduct a proper risk analysis and how GAO basically says it is not safe to conduct this research on the mainland. A complete review of this entire process needs to be conducted. We're back at square one again. However,
what's next on the horizon for you then?
Exactly. Now, DHS has said it doesn't care about the GAO report. It is moving forward with its plans to build the facility in Kansas, and now the only hope that I see is that Congress will intervene. As I said, the House Subcommittee on Oversight Investigations does intend to hold hearings on that report. The House has also voted to remove all appropriations for construction of the facility. However, the Senate has voted to fund construction, and it appears primarily because Senator Brownback and Senator Roberts want the MBAF in their home state. So we're now positioned for a classic clash between the House and the Senate over whether to appropriate money to continue DHS's plans to build this facility in Kansas.
Yeah, you mentioned the Kansas delegation. That's actually, I think, one of the sharper political delegations in the House and Senate, and both those senators are I think, very well thought of and largely driven by policy instincts as opposed to partisan politics. And so it will be interesting to see how that evolves. I'm sure they have their own set of arguments about why this is in the best interest of the United States and why, obviously, it's very good for Kansas. I've got just a minute or so to wrap up. What are your thoughts here on what you plan to do and how you see things playing out over the next few months?
Well, we do plan to work with Congress to ensure that if this moves forward, it's done in a safe manner. We are optimistic that Congress will delay funding for this program until after a thorough risk assessment is performed and GAO finally chops off on it. By the way, this is the second time GAO has found fault with DHS's analysis. So this needs to be done the right way, and we think Congress will reach that conclusion because the U.S. simply can't be responsible for another pandemic like what we're experiencing with the swine flu.
And with that, so let's say they do actually decline to fund it this year while they continue to talk about the right place for it. Do we continue research at Plum Island? It's not a case of the United States is missing out. You know, we have facilities that are currently doing this work.
That's correct. We've been doing this research at Plum Island for over 50 years, and there's no reason that that research can't continue while DHS makes a hopefully smart decision about how to move this program into the future.
And I suspect that despite the fact that you're talking about highly contagious pathogens, that there were other places in the United States that were considering applying, were considered by DHS, and might still be alternate candidates should the decision be made that, for whatever reason, Kansas isn't the right place.
That's correct. There are still many options available to DHS. It's just a question of making sure that it makes a decision that both promotes the research program, which ultimately will further our national security, without actually subjecting our own citizens to the risk of a release.
All right. Well, we've been joined by Michael Giuffre from the law firm of Patton Boggs talking about this interesting dispute between Department of Homeland Security and where to put their new highly toxic research lab here in the United States. We're going to be back next week with more exciting news from Washington as the health care reform debate rages on and Congress gets ready to leave town. We'll see you next Thursday here on Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.